We are in Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter.
Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that ye may do them in the land to which you were going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may greatly multiply, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be upon your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, then take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. For the Lord your God in the midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test, as you tested him at Massah. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, and his testimonies, and his statutes, which he has commanded you. And you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may go well with you, and that you may go in and take possession of the good land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers, by thrusting out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has promised. When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there, that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us.
What is the Hebrew word for commandments? It's a test. Mitzvah, or mitzvot, is the plurality here. Mitzvah. You heard the word mitzvah? That means commandments. And what does commandment mean? There are orders to follow. Right? And so we go through the book of Deuteronomy. He uses these words quite often. And so when someone says they got to do a mitzvah, mitzvot, or a mitzvah, that means they're obeying a commandment, not of the rabbis, nor of the ministry, nor of the priesthood, but of Yahweh, Elohim. Okay? And amongst these things, and this book is very, very heavy, if I use that word, in describing the whole point of the book is, by the way, about the commandments or the mitzvah and the statutes, which are chukim, which is plurality for statutes. What is judgments? It sounds like the other one of mitzvah. This is the paim. Mitzvahim. Paim. I'm going to keep myself pronounce that word right. And so we have these three things that are repeated quite often in the entire text. Now, when we look at this thing and we read this book, we say, what is the object thereof? Why is it written down, therefore? Verse 2? Okay, that's the object. Okay, that's the object of why it's written down there. Yeah. Now, fear does something to people, right? I better hear what he says and respond to what he says. And as we as sometimes as adults, we don't think we have to concern ourselves with fear. All we have to concern ourselves is with, oh, have I helped the poor today? Well, that's maybe okay for a commandment, but that's not the first priority, is it? First priority is to do the commandment that he says to do first. Remember, verse chapter 4, he talked about one of the greatest things of which we call a commandment is what? I already mentioned it earlier, talked about this young man. Do not take away and do not add. I know that many times when you probably have heard people try to have explanation of what is written and they bring in an interpretation thereof which is different than what is written or even different what he has shown us. When you think of the word Torah, what does it mean? There's three things as a It's a three-word meaning, by the way. First one is, or called instruction, all right? The second meaning has been used as, and it's direction. Well, it means the same thing. No. One's a teaching. The next is a direction. The last one is law. Oh. So there's three things that are involved. So there's a teaching or instruction, and then there is a direction he tells you to go. And if you don't know what the direction is, you go to the law. The law tells you what God wants you to do. Now we talked about the thing about statutes, remember? It's pre-determined task. It's a task that pre-existed before you were. Yes?
Well, you know, one of the things about the idea of Torah being instruction and law is that, well, if you're talking about what the Lord is instructing, that is the way he wants you to go. Otherwise, why would he say it?
So you can't separate
the three. So if you were to say, oh, that's baloney, then you are now going against what he's saying.
Right.
And thus, you're now going against the, you could say, the code or the direction he wants the universe to go into.
Right. So, what I'm saying is, the word is bigger than just a meaning of one thing. It has three big meanings within it. And yes, are they related? Yeah. Can you do one but not the other two? No. You have to fulfill and do and you have to be taught, right? You have to be instructed and told what direction to go. Then you got to go that direction. And then he says, now this is how I want you to do it. And you look at the law. Now we also know the Messiah says he's within the Torah. So he's more than just, you know, the Torah. He really does those three things and he teaches those three things and he commands those three things. You know, not one jot, not one tittle removed from the Torah. There's three things right there. So, I want to drop down to verse 5. And thou shalt love Yahuwah, thy Elohim. What does love, in a real simple terminology, mean? What does love in a simple terminology mean?
You mean the like the Hebrew word ahav?
That's good.
Yeah. I guess some ways is to have affection for.
Aha.
And I can.
There's another meaning to it also. What's that second meaning? To what? No. To be liked. Oh, I like you, and what else? I have affection for you. Now, have you heard people say, well, I have to love you, but I don't have to like you? You've heard that statement before? That's not Torah. That's not what it says. You cannot say, well, I like God, but I don't love him. You can't say, well, I love God, but I don't like him. You can't do that, right? So it has a twofold meaning in those terminologies. When you really like somebody, you're going to do something for them, right? Well, same thing if you really do have to cherish them and you like them, you want to be part of their world, want to give them something or do something for them. Now, when you do something for them, that's showing love. So you can't separate the two. Do you understand what I'm saying? For many, many years, I have taught that people, we have this thing, well, I don't have to like him, I just have to love him. Because that could, all Jesus said, you got to love your enemies. So I have to like him too? Yeah. Ooh. I got to think about that one. And you back off. It's a hard one, isn't it? It's very hard. Yes.
A nice New Testament connection, Richard, is when John said, love is the fulfilling of Torah.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Simple and put. Simple as that. Now, where this thing is in thy heart. You know what that heart means in Hebrew? I got your little thing in. I'm harassing Jeff back there. What does heart mean? Where did it come from? Well, I'll just ask a simple question, first of all. Where is your physical heart? It's where? It's within you. All right? So in Hebrew, when they talk about this thing of the heart, they're talking about, go begging it down, it's the inner part of you. It's the inner section that becomes aware of and joins with. Another Hebrew terminology, it also means being intelligent. So the Lord God said, I will put my laws, my Torah, in your mind, and I also will put my Torah in your heart. It means deep down an inner part of you. And so when we use this word heart, yes, it's a, how else can you explain that word, right? Because your blood circulates, the heart circulates through the blood, and it gives you, it keeps you alive. Well, say the same thing about the Torah. When it's planted within your innermost part of you, it flows and you stay alive. And by the way, out of your belly, which is the inner part of you again, comes forth what? Dead water, bad water, cold, or living water. Okay, so she's got to see it written here also in Hebrew, way back then, even before it's even mentioned. Yes, John.
YouTube, someone sent me yesterday, actually, that really ties in with this, Richard. It's something maybe we know somewhat, but they now know that the same cells that are in the brain, some of them are found in the heart and also found in the gut.
Yeah.
So from a physiological perspective,
cool.
Believe it or not, we now know that the human body has three brains, if you will, in our head, in our heart, and in our gut.
Belly.
And that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't. That's fascinating. So when we come into this terminology, we'll get down there. to where it says, you love the Lord your heart with all your heart, with all your soul, nephesh, and all your might. By the way, do you know what might means? Interesting, I had to look it up. Okay, why this word might, you know? And I used to think it meant that, and I had to do some research on this one. And it's very fascinating. It comes from a terminology referring to if you have a bonfire and you're supposed to gather together the rest of the hot coals. You don't let them scatter out. What? What does that got to do with might? The fire becomes mightier if the coals are put together. If they're scattered out, what happens to them? They get cold and burn out. So he says, keep the fire burning. Bring the coals in and feed more fuel to it. That's where the terminology came from. But we kind of, it's an odd word to where it actually came from. I find it very funny. But in order to try to explain it a little bit differently, it's like putting all of your strength together in one place. Putting all of your intellect, your mind, your spirit, your soul, into one spot. One, in a sense, achad. They're all together, and they are. So every part of your being, not just the mind and or the heart or the mind, but including other things that has looked like they're scattered out there, bring them together. And that's what we do when we have before God. We love the Lord our God with all our might. We're putting together everything that we have that is not, quote, part of the heart or part of the nephesh, but part of us. Everything. Yes, Jeff.
One of the interesting ways I describe this to kids is that, you know, the heart being the inward part, it's kind of like your character, who you really are. When everything is stripped away, your soul comes from a word related to breath.
Yes.
So, like a ship, it's what moves you along. It's your motivation, the things that really get you going, the things that you want to do.
Yeah, without it, you wouldn't.
And the strength is the idea of passion, your drive. You know, you want to do something, but okay, are you actually going to do it? It's the passion that actually puts your motives into actually doing something. So you combine them all together. You know, it comes from who you actually are when everything is stripped away. It's what you want to do, and then you actually are going to do it.
It also has another meaning, though, on the word might. Has the word abundance. All of your abundance, love the Lord your God. What I own, with what I have, with what I do for work, what part is left out? So what's that mean when you're gathering all the things together? That includes everything you do, every function you do, every action you do, all right? Now, let's go on down to I just want to put a key thing here. Did I miss that part I want to talk about? Probably did. Let me backtrack. Verse 4. We all know what it says. Most translations got it okay. I find it interesting that in Hebrew it has a little different phrase. It says, Shema, O Israel, Adonai, our Elohim, okay, Yahuwah, first let's put back, be back. Yahuwah, our Elohim, Yahuwah is one. That's what it says. It was Echad. In Hebrew, they use the word Yahweh twice, or Yahuwah twice, and Echad is connected to the name, Yahuwah. And so there, or Yahweh, or however you wish to pronounce it. And it's not that you're, in most translations, they're just fine, you know, with all your heart, with all your soul, and you know, behold, you know, that your God is one. That's okay. But I think it's very interesting in Hebrew that they quote that, your Elohim, Yahuwah, Echad. And it's kind of interesting to what we're looking at. Now, what does Echad really mean when you think about it in this phrase? We actually think sometimes in mind there's only one God. Right? Who's he talking to? Who's Moses talking to? The people of Israel. Yahuwah is the one. That is your God. Yahuwah is the one. And we know from scripture here that Yahuwah, we'll get the word jealousy in a minute, and he comes in there and he says, you will not have any other Elohim, not have any other one. You will have only me as the one in your world, in your life, in your existence, and everything you do. Let other nations have their Elohim. I am the one. O Israel, I am the one. I am Echad to you. Now we know in time, God increases his wisdom and knowledge, his power to a lot more people. We also know that took place in the whole story even in the Torah. So it's kind of interesting way of looking at that and trying to look at it from a different point of view, rather than thinking that there's only one God and no other God. No, a different phrase in Hebrew, and it's referring to that Echad, the one, your Elohim, Yahuwah, is the one for you. Because it didn't say the world's Yahuwah, it says yours. Let's go quickly, and then we'll go on to a few more things. Oh, jeez. I think I'll wait for that one later. Let's quickly go to verse 15. Now, there's a lot of things in between there that we need to talk about, too. I'm going to go to verse 15. It's an unusual word in our English language when it says that God is a jealous God. We have a hard time what that means. And because we relate this word with humans, right? Well, this particular word in Hebrew only relates to Yahweh. It doesn't relate to anybody else. Him and him alone. Now, we know it comes from the word zeal, because it could be either jealousy or zealous. Zealous. Jealous or jealous. And it has a meaning of name it like it is. You could say it's envious, and you could say it's jealousy or zealousy. Now, jealousy is the word zealous means full of or characterized by or due to being a zealous. And you are the one who is devoted and diligent and you're fervent. Remember Yahshua was, what was he? About the house. Remember he came down and had to destroy the house? Not the house, but I mean the people doing the selling of things. And he said he was zealous for the house of God. Now, that's how God is. When it comes to that point, it's the zealous meaning, was he nice? Was he angry? Was he pleasant? Was he a nice guy? What did he do? You remember? He picked up a whip. You remember? And he hit the money changers with the whip. Oh, that's not a very good Messiah, is it? Ellie.
He was intense toward God. And we get into a lot of trouble as believers because we take him literally and we are intense. And we change our lives and people say, you're just too dogmatic, or you're too fanatical, or you're too, there's a lot of terms, but it's intensity toward doing what is good.
Right. On the 14th verse here, he's talking about what? You shall not go after another Elohim. Of the Elohim of the people which were around about you. Now remember I just said that we go back to where it says the Lord your God is Echad, the one. Who is he talking to? The house of Israel. He's not getting rid of these Elohims in the land that they are going to go to. He doesn't remove them. So what is the commandment he's told them to do? He didn't remove them at all, did he? What did he command the Israelites to do? No. Doesn't say that. You will not go after them. You will not follow, whom? The Canaanites? No, the Elohim. Their Elohim. And that takes upon you and me to also take a look at a certain, that's a direct relationship, right? What other Elohim would you respond to? Now, the Apostle Paul talks about an idol, right? And he talks about that the lust, you lust after something, is called an idol. That means you are actually going after another power other than God. Right? What power do you have? Oh, some things of stone and stick have nothing. But when God says there are other Elohim, we have a hard time accepting that because we don't know what that word really means. One who has power and might is the word El, meaning the powerful one, or the high mountain one, the one on the top of the mountain. Now, when Moses was at the burning bush place. You remember that? Burning bush place, yeah. There's something that burning bush said to him. Remember what he said? Okay. What else? Okay. What else? Very interesting words that he said. Because Moses doubted the voice. And then the voice said, you, it will prove to you who I am because you're going to bring back the people to this mountain. Remember that? And he did. To prove to Moses, not Israelites, to Moses, that God is going to do that. Now, when Moses brought him back to that area, what happened on top of that mountain? Was it a burning bush? What happened? Oh, now I'm God on fire. So here we are. When we look at these things, and he says, I'm going to read it in a Young's literal translation, but the few words changed. For a zealous Elohim is Yahuwah, thy Elohim, in thy midst. Now that's a warning. Lest the anger of Yahuwah, thy Elohim, burn against thee. Every time when God uses the word burn, what do you think he's talking about? Oh, it's just hot day. No, it's fire. We already read in the previous chapter, I think in the fifth chapter, fourth chapter, and it says, thy God is a consuming fire. pretty hot one, didn't you think so? So he comes here and he says, don't let that fire attack you. What happens? Why would it come and why would it burn you? Because you have gone after another Elohim. That's what verse 14 says, right? So when we think about this in our own world, in our own life, as we walk through this life, we got to be careful not to compromise and think, okay, I think I'll do this, even though the Word of God says do that, because it's easier or more pleasant or more wonderful. And he's going to have a bad time with him. In verse 14, it says, you shall diligently keep. Basically means, heap ye shall heap. Heap you shall heap the commandments, the mitzvah, or mitzvot in this case. Yer Elohim. You shall heap upon heap. You shall build upon build. You'll pile upon pile. Now, that kind of strange, right? When God said, actually, Paul. He says, you grow in grace and knowledge, right? So you're growing, you're heap upon heap, growth upon growth, knowledge upon knowledge, and you have to have something else be given to you. And that's, what else? Grace, grace, grace. God has more favor, more favor, more favor for you when you keep on building that. And Peter, I can't remember which book it in, but he names all the characteristics of the nature of God. When on your faith, add this virtue, and then add this knowledge, and so on and so forth, all the way down. You're building it up, basically. And so when you add upon heap, heap upon heap, is the terminology here in Hebrew, that you will heap upon heap the things that Elohim has said. You'll build, and you build, and you build, and you build. And you come to a point where you are, and Jeff mentioned, I think it was last 2 weeks ago, lack nothing. Explain what that really meant in the language, right? Very fascinating approach. Oh, are there any questions? No one has any more questions? I've got some questions. Yes.
Well, it's interesting when you're talking about jealousy and zeal and such, and a lot of people, as you were mentioning, think of this in human terms, and it seems pretty capricious, arbitrary, and such, you know, well...
Like, we're out of control.
Well, you know, God is just a bully of the universe, and throwing his weight around, because he feels like it and he can do it. But when you think about it, the... fire that burns, it's the reason why we don't burn all the time or burn at any given moment is because we are shielded from it. I mean, if you think about it, like a nuclear power plant. Nuclear power plant is perfectly safe if it was built right and operated correctly. Because the stuff, the really, really bad stuff, is shielded from everybody, and you can keep your lights on, you can run your dishwasher, everything is fine. But if you don't follow procedures, if someone cut corners, decided, hey, I'm not going to do it a little bit differently, blew it, and thus you got a big problem. Then you got Chernobyl, and now fuel rods are thrown all over the place. And now everybody's at risk because, you know, line of sight to a fuel rod, and you're going to be dead pretty quickly. Well, what do you do about it? And fortunately, at Chernobyl, it took people who sacrificed themselves to go physically pick up those things, you know, a couple hundred pounds apiece, and throw them down into what used to be the pressure chamber of the reactor, and they were dead pretty much within a couple hours. But it took them to do that because pure exposure to those fuel rods, you're toast. But if they're shielded from everything, no problem. So thus, when you're talking about the sheer power and God's zeal, is that, you know, he in his mercy is shielding us from the, what you could say, pure exposure to who he actually is. And we live in this fantasy land thinking that we can just run off in a parallel perpendicular to his direction, and that everything will be just fine. Yet we live in a universe that he upholds, he created, and he exists. So, thus, if we were to be there and exist anywhere near him with who he actually is, we'd be go up like a candle very, very, very quickly. So, in that sense, his zeal for us is to protect us from what would happen otherwise.
Another.
The same thing, Jeff. We have a fireplace at home. Fire is in that fireplace. And you know, if I'm really stupid, I could put a whole bunch of stuff in that and I can set a chimney fire on fire and I can burn down my whole house because I didn't use the power of it the way the laws say to use it. Which brings me to a conversation that we were having, Daryl, about no one can keep the commandments. So, since no one can keep the commandments, I should go kill people so that I can prove to God that I love him? Wait, that doesn't make any sense. I'll burn the whole house down that way. I'm supposed to have knowledge of God is supposed to bring wisdom, and we're supposed to be able to read this chapter that says, if you fear the Lord your God and keep his commandments and his commandments that I command you, you and your son and your grandsons, all of the days of your life, that your days be prolonged. That's pretty simple. Just do the rules. Keep the fire in the fireplace. Don't put a whole bunch of paper on there that'll run it up the fireplace or let fuel rods blow everywhere because we didn't think ahead about the rules. What is hard about that?
Well, you know, one of the things about like working with construction equipment and such like that is that sometimes I put like a blade guard on something. Now, blade guard can be inconvenient because they keep moving the thing around and it gets in your way and this and that.
Difficulty.
And the other. However, if you take the thing off, you better know
this will happen to you.
You better know what you're doing and you better realize the immense risk you're taking in doing so.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you do not fear the blade or fear the fire or fear the fuel rods, you know, you're in a world of hurt if you try to cut corners.
Now, with this subject matter he's bringing in here, I'm going to ask a question. We've heard of the phrase, people can go to hell if they play cards. Play cards. Go to hell if you drink wine. You go to hell, and if they believe it's an ever-burning hell, right? Now, what's the number one thing here that God says that can get you all burnt up?
You got it. That is the number one thing. So when people don't even know that knowledge, God's not going to hold it against them. Well, and behold, when they understand it, they're going to have to do like you did. And what you are doing.
No other one. Because why? Because now this is the warning against those who do not know God. They never saw the action of God. They didn't ever knew who his name was. Oh no, we're talking 40 years later. This whole generation knew the name. This whole generation understood an awful lot. The other generation passed away. This one knows. And now the warning as they go into that promised land, you're going to get burnt. Jeff?
So it's really a sense that you know that there is one, but then decide to choose another.
Yeah. I don't like this one. I want that one. Have you ever been a child before where you would really prefer that cookie instead of the one over here? Mama gives you that one, but you want that one?
He says, I don't want that one. I want that one. You ever heard that before? That's what human beings do, right? So I was told some men years ago, and I said, sometimes the problem is that you have two cookies in your hand already that God has given you, and you're saying, I want a cookie. You got two of them already. And he says, no, no more. But. You already got two. If you don't use it, don't eat it, I'm not going to give you another one. And they stopped and thought about, okay, jokingly, they start eating the cookie. Okay, my hand's free. Eat the other one too. Jokingly. It's just a funny joke. Yes.
Well, it kind of got me thinking of recently, I was with a congregation that was celebrating communion, you know, the Lord's Supper and such like that. And the idea of Lord's Supper, in this case, done on a quarterly basis throughout the year and such. And so the pastor was explaining to the congregation that he's had quite a few people come up and it's like, what's the deal with the little unleavened bread thing and the grape juice and this and that? So he ended up having to take the whole congregation through a Passover for dummies view of what the Passover was, what the unleavened bread was, and such like that. And he was mentioning that, well, what is the Lord's Supper, that took over for the Passover, but you can't understand the Lord's Supper without the Passover. So it's one of those things that if you think that you're now going on to something new and some new creation of something that was instituted, and yet you forget the old thing because that's obsolete and this and that, yet the new thing that supposedly came in has no meaning without what the old was.
Correct.
So unless you celebrate the new meaning with the old meaning.
Yeah, you got to begin with the...
Yeah.
To get the picture of what it's about. The end's greater, but you better know where it started.
Yeah, because otherwise it doesn't have any meaning. It's like today when people try to talk about the idea of a savior, but then you start disregarding the view of where sin comes from to begin with, then the idea of a savior has no meaning.
Okay, now I'm going to go backtrack a little bit here and see if you have an answer to them. All right? And it says here, verse 7, thou shalt teach them, your children, unto the third and fourth generation, basically, unto thy children, and shall talk of them when you sit in thy house, when thou walk with by the way, and when thou lie down, and when thou rise up. That statement alone, who is the best teacher for any child? The parents. Parents are the best teachers. Not the worst, the best. They're not mediocre, they're the best. That's why you should honor your father and your mother. They're the best teachers you've ever had. They say, oh yeah, my mom was this way, my mom was that way, my dad was this way, my dad was that way. No. They actually taught you more than you probably would know. Hard to kind of picture it up, but sometimes they've taught you more than you may know. Sometimes the way you are is because of what they taught you. Maybe not by word of mouth only, but by actions and deeds and other things they may have done. But here we're talking about God. And he says, now, when they ask this question, what are you going to do? The word diligently, by the way, it's a very interesting word in Hebrew. Shanan. It means to sharpen. To sharpen your children. To make them keen. To pierce them with the word. It's not just, oh, I told him, but he didn't listen. I told him what it was all about, and he just kind of ignored it. No, you've got to sharpen it. You've got to make it keen, make the child be very aware of and pierce his ears, we can use that word, or pierce his brain, that he will not forget it. And physically, you pierce someone's head, do they forget it? I don't think so. It's very painful. Yes, Ellie.
Is that called making your point?
Making your point. Okay, you say that way, yeah. Now, verse 8. And thou shalt bind them as a sign upon thy hand, and it shall be a frontlet between thy eyes. Do you have an answer for that? And you shall write them on thy post of thy house and on thy gates. Okay? Do you have an answer to that?
Go through your day.
Okay. Anybody else have it? Don't be bashful. Just tell me what you think. You may be right. And I may be wrong.
Well, a lot of us as Christians to write them and disdain a mezuzah. But when you have a mezuzah and you look at it, you're aware that in that house, the commandments are taught coming and going every time you go through that doorway.
Okay. So, how do you teach your children as you walk with them, as you travel with them, when you lie down with them, or you get up with them? Do you just say, oh, there's a mezuzah right there. Let's go. No. You do them. You had going to make a comment there, Jeff?
One common thing that people will say is that, well, you don't need to physically do that because these are spiritual lessons. So you just do the spiritual lesson and you don't need the physical lesson because the physical lesson is obsolete and such like that. But the interesting thing about that is, you know, because people say, well, you know, you put the mezuzah up and then you forget about it and you don't even realize it's there after a while. You know, but the point is that when you look in the prophets, what do they talk about? And even in the Psalms, in Psalm 51, it's talking about, you know, even the sacrifices you did not desire. Well, God said that he wanted them. But it's not like the sacrifices in and of themselves are anything. It's the contrite heart. And if you miss the point of what the physical thing is, you're not getting the spiritual aspect. So just focusing on the spiritual aspect without some sort of physical grounding, then you can forget it both ways.
Okay.
So it's like one of the reasons for reminders that come up every few months and such, is to have some sort of physical peg to be a reminder, whether it be a mezuzah, whether it be the tefillin, whether it be a feast day, everything, you know, Shabbat, you're always getting a reminder of something. And whether you decide to have that come into your life and your character, it's between you and God.
Okay, I'm going to backtrack. Go ahead.
There was a movie made in the 1960s. About how you didn't really have to study and work at it or write it down. It was called The Music Man. And if you just went around with your trumpet for a while, pretty soon you'd be just playing the trumpet and with all this music. And it was fraudulent. It doesn't work. You have to put forth effort. It has to be written down. You have
it's
to
on
do
the
it.
The Sound of Music, right? You're talking about the middle of Sound of Music?
No, The Music Man.
Oh, The Music Man, okay. I don't know about that. I got another
one.
Anyway, I want to reemphasize here. Because when we talk about that which is to be bound, okay, it does mean to bind or to tie together, put together, or to bind oneself. It can mean, and often does mean, to bind oneself for something. What is it says for? For what? Read it. Verse 8, please. You are binded to your... For what reason? For a sign. Oh, I know what a sign is. A flag. A sign, yeah. Traffic sign. Stop sign. I have an address on my... I guess a sign on my address. That's not what that Hebrew word really refers to. Yes, it can be translated, and it is translated sign and signal. It's a signal. But the verb, what do you think the verb means? It means to consent to. To consent to. So there's a something on your hand that is a something you are to consent to. You are to agree with what? Now you're putting something, quote, on your hand, and it's something that you're telling your hand you are going to agree with. I am going to consent to. What? Teaching your children. You're going to put your hand to the plow. Heard that statement before? Okay. So when we look at it from that point, we say, okay, now the hand is going to be consenting to something. And it's going to be doing something. And the previous statement was, teach your children diligently. And make sure that you make your hand do its job. Consent to what I am telling you and teaching you. Consent and agree with it. Now we know the hand has a great deal with what you do, how you operate, what your work is, and everything else. But here we're talking about your children. Did you ever notice that before? We're going to go back on a few of these things just a minute. And the next thing is that they shall be a frontlet. Where? Between the eyes. Frontlet, by the way, is an old English word. Today, we kind of use it loose-handed. It only referred to when that word was first, in quote, invented, used. Referring to the forehead of an animal. Not the forehead of men, but forehead of an animal. So when you saw a goat, you see frontlet. Where is the frontlet? Right between the eyes. A steer. Where is the frontlet? Right between the eyes. A goat. Where is the frontlet? Right between the eyes. So what does it tell you? So now, he says it's going to be a sign upon your hand, and it will be also in Hebrew, a sign between your eyes. You're going to consent to and agree with. Why would the Hebrew, or why would God use the word between the eyes?
We used to raise sheep, and sheep and goats and those animals, when they fight or disagree with each other, they clash, they clang heads. And that is, I guess you could say they're hard-headed, and this would imply that your hard-headedness toward, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to fight anything that's in my way to do it.
All right. When we think about the phrase, between your eyes, is God saying, that which is inside the head, the brain, the flesh behind? Or is it saying there's something between, oh, I need to see something? That's why it says what it says. Exodus. We talk about all these things and they try to figure out what to do. I want you to come back because I've told you, and the very first verses has to do with what you do with your children, right? Teach your children diligently. Your hand must consent and agree. And your eyes must also consent and agree. Right? The first time this was used is in the book of Exodus. We all kind of know about it. It has to do about the Passover. Actually, afterwards, starting chapter 13, verse 11, and it hath been that Yahuwah brings thee into the land of the Canaanite, as he has sworn to thee and to thy fathers, and hath given it unto thee, that thou shalt cause every one opening a womb to pass over to Yahuwah, and that every first and increased the beast which is without has, the males are Yahuwah's. And every firstling of the ass and the first and that thou ransom with the lamb, and if thou dost not ransom it, then thou shalt behead it. And every firstborn of male among thy sons thou shalt ransom with a lamb, by the way. And it shall be that when thy son ask thee thereafter, saying, what is this? That thou hast said, that thou shalt say unto him, my strength of hand, by strength of hand, rather, has Yahweh brought us out of Egypt from a house of servants. Yea, it comes to pass when Pharaoh hath been pained to send us away, that Yahuwah did slay every firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of man, even to the firstborn of beast, referring to male here. And therefore I have sacrificed to Yahweh all opening at the womb are males, and every firstborn of my sons I ransom. And it shall be for a token or a sign on your hand, your hand's going to yield to or agree with and go along with, and a frontlet between your eyes, for by strength of the hand hath Yahweh brought you out of Egypt. See, now this is the association, isn't it? Teach your children diligently. You also can go, well, we'll go there today because we'll catch up sometime in the future. Has the same concept in Deuteronomy 11th chapter. So what I'm telling you, what I see, what I understand, I could be wrong. And we talk about this thing of your hand and your eyes. Subject matter has to do with your children. They also must learn that their hand does something. And their eyes see something. How can their hands not do something, agree with, unless they see your hands doing and agreeing, just like it says there in the book of Exodus? Right? How can they see something if they don't see you seeing something? You understand what I'm saying? This is the depth which I feel this is really subject matters about. I'm not against anybody, by the way, if you're very clear, of putting something on their hand or something in the forehead. That's just a belief system. But I'm saying the centering in of these three places, including the 16th chapter of Deuteronomy, has to do with your children. How you teach your children. What do you teach them? What your hand does. What else do you teach your children? What your eyes see focus in on and observe.